checkered hunter's cap. That was when I realized that I'd left my hat on his bed. We were on our way down Maiden Hill. Dan had said he'd meet us with the car at the boathouse on the Swayze Parkway.
"Just a second," I told Owen. "I forgot my hat."
I ran back to the house. I left him kicking at a rock that had been frozen in the ruts of the dirt driveway. I didn't knock. The clump of pine boughs on the door was blocking the most natural place to knock, anyway. Mr. Meany was standing by the mantel, either looking at the creche or at the fire.
"Just forgot my hat," I said when he looked up at me.
I didn't knock on the door of Owen's room, either. At first, I thought the dressmaker's dummy had moved. I thought that somehow it had found a way to bend at the waist and had sat down on Owen's bed. Then I realized that Mrs. Meany was sitting on the bed. She was staring quite intently at my mother's figure, and she did not interrupt her gaze when I entered the room.
"Just forgot my hat," I repeated.
I couldn't tell if she heard me. I put on my hat and was leaving the room, closing the door as quietly as I could behind me, when she said, "I'm sorry about your poor mother." It was the first time she had ever spoken to me. I peeked back into the room. Mrs. Meany hadn't moved. She sat with her head slightly bowed to the dressmaker's dummy, as if she were awaiting some instructions. It was noon when Owen and I passed under the railroad trestle bridge at the foot of the Maiden Hill Road, a few hundred yards below the Meany Granite Quarry. Years later, the abutment of that bridge would be the death of Buzzy Thurston, who had successfully evaded the draft. But that Christmas of 53, when Owen and I walked under the bridge, was the first time our being there coincided with the passing of the Flying Yankee, the express train that raced between Portland and Boston in just 2 hours. It screamed through Gravesend every day at noon, and although Owen and I had watched it hurtle through town from the Gravesend Depot, and although we had put pennies on the tracks for the Flying Yankee to flatten, we had never before been directly under the trestle bridge exactly as the Flying Yankee was passing over us. I was still thinking of Mrs. Meany's attitude of supplication before my mother's dummy when the trestle work of the bridge began to rattle. A fine grit sifted down between the railroad ties and the trestles and settled upon Owen and me. Even the concrete abutments shook, and, shielding our eyes from the loosened sand, we looked up to see the giant, dark underbelly of the train speeding above us. Through the gaps between the passing cars, flashes of the leaden winter sky blinked down on us.
"It's the Flying Yankee!"
Owen managed to scream above the clamor. All trains were special to Owen Meany, who had never ridden on a train. But the Flying Yankee, its terrifying speed, and its refusal to stop in Gravesend, represented to Owen the zenith of travel. Owen, who had never been anywhere, was a considerable romantic on the subject of travel.
"What a coincidence,"
I said, when the Flying Yankee had gone. I meant that it was a far-fetched piece of luck that had landed us under the trestle bridge precisely at noon, but Owen smiled at me, with his especially irritating combination of mild pity and mild contempt. Of course, I know now that Owen didn't believe in coincidences. Owen Meany believed that coincidence was a stupid, shallow refuge sought by stupid, shallow people who were unable to accept the fact that their lives were shaped by a terrifying and awesome design, more powerful and unstoppable than the Flying Yankee. The maid, who looked after my grandmother, the maid who was Lydia's replacement after Lydia suffered her amputation, was named Ethel, and she was forced to endure the subtle comparisons that both Lydia and my grandmother made of her job effectiveness. I say subtle, only because my grandmother and Lydia never discussed these comparisons with Ethel directly. But in Ethel's company, grandmother would say,
"Do you remember, Lydia, how you used to bring up the jams and jellies from those shelves in the secret passageway, where they get so dusty?" And line them all up in the kitchen according to the dates when you'd put them up?
Yes, I remember,
Lydia would say. That way I could look them over and say, well, we should throw out that one. It doesn't seem to be a favorite around here, and it's 2 years old. Do you remember?
My grandmother would ask.
Yes. 1 year we threw out all the quince, Lydia said. It was just pleasant to know what we had down there in the secret passageway, my grandmother remarked. Don't let things get the upper hand on you, I always say, Lydia said.
And the next morning, of course, poor Ethel, properly, albeit indirectly instructed, would haul out all the jams and jellies and dust them off for my grandmother's inspection. Ethel was a short, heavy-set woman, with an ageless, blocky strength. Yet her physical power was undermined by a slow mind and a brutal lack of confidence. Her forward motion, even with something as basic as cleaning the house, was characterized by the strong swipes of her stubby arms. But these confident efforts were followed or preceded by the hesitant, off-balance steps of her short, broad feet upon her thick ankles. She was a stumbler. Owen said she was too slow-witted to frighten properly, and therefore we rarely bothered her, even when we discovered opportunities to surprise her in the dark in the secret passageway. In this way, too, Ethel was Lydia's inferior, for Lydia had been great fun to terrorize when she had two legs. The maid hired to look after Lydia was, as we used to say in Gravesend, a whole other ballgame. Her name was Germaine, and both Lydia and Ethel bullied her. My grandmother purposefully ignored her. Among these contemptuous women, poor Germaine had the disadvantage of being young and almost pretty in a shy, mousy way. She possessed the nonspecific clumsiness of someone who makes such a constant effort to be inconspicuous that she is creatively awkward. Without meaning to, Germaine hoarded attention to herself. Her almost electric nervousness disturbed the atmosphere surrounding her. Windows, when Germaine was attempting to slip past them, would suddenly shut themselves. Doors would open. Precious vases would totter when Germaine approached them. When she reached to steady them, they would shatter. Lydia's wheelchair would malfunction the instant Germaine took tremulous command of it. The light in the refrigerator would burn out the instant Germaine opened the door, and when the garage light was left on all night, it would be discovered, in my grandmother's early morning investigation, that Germaine had been the last to bed.
"Last one to bed turns out the lights,"
Lydia would say in her litanic fashion. "I was not only in bed, but I was asleep when Germaine came to bed," Ethel would announce. "I know I was asleep because she woke me up."
"I'm sorry," Germaine would whisper.
My grandmother would sigh and shake her head, as if several rooms of the great house had been consumed in a fire overnight and there was nothing to salvage and nothing to say, either. But I know why my grandmother sought to ignore Germaine. Grandmother, in a fit of Yankee frugality, had given Germaine all my mother's clothes. Germaine was a little too small for the clothes, although they were the nicest clothes Germaine had ever owned, and she wore them both happily and reverentially. Germaine never realized that my grandmother resented seeing her in such painfully familiar attire. Perhaps my grandmother never knew how much she would resent seeing those clothes on Germaine when she gave them to her, and grandmother had too much pride to admit her error. She could only look away. That the clothes didn't fit Germaine was referred to as Germaine's fault.
"You should eat more, Germaine,"
grandmother would say, not looking at her and never noticing what Germaine ate, only that my mother's clothes hung limply on her. But Germaine could have gorged herself and never matched my mother's bosom.
"John,"
Germaine would whisper when she would enter the secret passageway. The one overhead bulb at the bottom of those winding stairs never lit that passageway very brightly.
"Owen," she would ask, "are you in here? Don't frighten me."
and Owen and I would wait until she had turned the L-shaped corner between the tall, dusty shelves at shoulder level, the odd shadows of the jam and jelly jar zigzagging across the cobwebbed ceiling, the higher, more irregular shadows cast by the bigger jars of tomato and sweet pepper relish, and the brandied plums were as looming and contorted as volcanic conformations.
"Be not afraid,"
Owen would whisper to Germaine in the dark. Once, over that Christmas vacation, Germaine burst into tears.
"I'm sorry,"
Owen called after her.
"It's just me."
But it was Owen whom Germaine was especially afraid of. She was a girl who believed in the supernatural, in what she was always calling signs. For example, the rather commonplace mutilation and murder of a robin by one of the Front Street cats. To witness this torture was a sure sign you would be involved with an even greater violence yet to come. Owen himself was taken as a sign by poor Germaine. His diminutive size suggested to her that Owen was small enough to actually enter the body and soul of another person and cause that person to perform unnatural acts. It was a dinner table conversation about Owen's voice that revealed to me Germaine's point of view concerning that unnatural aspect of him. My grandmother had asked me if Owen or his family had ever taken any pains to inquire if something could be done about Owen's voice.
"I mean medically,"
grandmother said, and Lydia nodded so vigorously that I thought her hairpins might fall onto her dinner plate. I knew that my mother had once suggested to Owen that her old voice and singing teacher might be able to offer Owen some advice of a corrective kind, or even suggest certain vocal exercises designed to train Owen to speak more, well, normally. My grandmother and Lydia exchanged their usual glances upon the mere mention of that voice and singing teacher. I explained further that Mother had even written out the address and telephone number of this mysterious figure, and she had given the information to Owen. Owen, I was sure, had never contacted the teacher.
"And why not?"
Grandmother asked. "Why not, indeed?" Lydia appeared to ask, nodding and nodding. Lydia's nodding was the most detectable manifestation of how her senility was in advance of my grandmother's senility, or so my grandmother had observed, privately, to me. Grandmother was extremely, almost clinically, interested in Lydia's senility, because she took Lydia's behavior as a barometer regarding what she could soon expect of herself. Ethel was clearing the table, in her curious combination of aggression and slow motion. She took too many dishes at one time, but she lingered at the table with them for so long that you were sure she was going to put some of them back. I think now that she was just collecting her thoughts concerning where she would take the dishes. Germaine was also clearing, the way a crippled swallow might swoop down for a crumb off your plate at a picnic. Germaine took too little away, one spoon at a time, and often the wrong spoon, or else she took your salad fork before you'd been served your salad. But if her disturbance of your dinner area was slight and fanciful, it was also fraught with Germaine's vast potential for accident. When Ethel approached, you feared a landslide of plates might fall in your lap, but this never happened. When Germaine approached, you guarded your plate and silverware, fearing that something you needed would be snatched from you and that your water glass would be toppled during the sudden flighty attack, and this often happened. It was, therefore, within this anxious arena of having the dinner table cleared that I announced to my grandmother and Lydia why Owen Meany had not sought the advice of Mother's voice and singing teacher.
"Owen doesn't think it's right to try to change his voice," I said.
Ethel, lumbering away from the table under the considerable burden of the two serving platters, the vegetable bowl, and all our dinner plates and silver, held her ground. My grandmother, sensing Germaine's darting presence, held her water glass in one hand, her wine glass in the other.
"Why on earth doesn't he think it's right?" she asked,
as Germaine pointlessly removed the peppermill and let the salt shaker stay.
He thinks his voice is for a purpose, that there's a reason for his voice being like that, I said.
What reason? My grandmother asked. Ethel had approached the kitchen door, but she seemed to be waiting, shifting her vast armload of dishes, wondering, possibly, if she should take them into the living room instead. Germaine positioned herself directly behind Lydia's chair, which made Lydia tense.
"Owen thinks his voice comes from God,"
I said quietly, as Germaine, reaching for Lydia's unused dessert spoon, dropped the peppermill into Lydia's water glass.
"Merciful heavens," Lydia said.
This was a pet phrase of my grandmother's, and grandmother eyed Lydia as if this thievery of her favorite language were another manifestation of Lydia's senility being in advance of her own. To everyone's astonishment, Germaine spoke.
"I think his voice comes from the devil," Germaine said.
"Nonsense," my grandmother said. "Nonsense to it coming from God or from the devil. It comes from granite. That's what it comes from. He breathed in all that dirt when he was a baby. It made his voice queer, and it stunted his growth."
Lydia, nodding, prevented Germaine from trying to extract the peppermill from her water glass. To be safe, she did it herself. Ethel stumbled into the kitchen door with a great crash. The door swung wide, and Germaine fled the dining room with absolutely nothing in her hands. My grandmother sighed deeply. Even to grandmother sighing, Lydia nodded, a more modest little nod.
"From God,"
my grandmother repeated contemptuously. And then she said,
"The address and phone number of the voice and singing teacher. I don't suppose your little friend would have kept it, not if he didn't intend to use it, I mean."
To this artful question, my grandmother and Lydia exchanged their usual glances. But I considered the question carefully. Its many levels of seriousness were apparent to me. I knew this was information that my grandmother had never known, and how it must have interested her. And, of course, I also knew that Owen would never have thrown this information away. That he never intended to make use of the information was not the point. Owen rarely threw anything away, and something that my mother had given him would not only have been saved, it would have been enshrined. I am indebted to my grandmother for many things, among them the use of an artful question.
"Why would Owen have kept it?"
I asked her, innocently. Again grandmother sighed. Again Lydia nodded.
"Why, indeed," Lydia said sadly.
It was my grandmother's turn to nod. They were both getting old and frail, I observed, but what I was thinking was why I had decided to keep Owen's probable possession of the singing teacher's address and phone number to myself. I didn't know why. Not then. What I know now is that Owen Meany would have quickly said it was
no coincidence.
And what would he have said regarding our discovery that we were not alone in the Christmas use we made of the empty rooms in Waterhouse Hall? Would he have termed it
no coincidence,
too, that we, one afternoon, were engaged in our usual investigations of a second-floor room when we heard another master key engage the lock on the door? I was into the closet in a hurry, fearful that the empty coat hangers would not entirely have stopped chiming together by the time the new intruder entered the room. Owen scooted under the bed. He lay on his back, with his hands crossed upon his chest like a soldier in a hasty grave. At first, we thought Dan had caught us, but Dan was rehearsing the Gravesend Players, unless, in despair, he had fired the lot of them and canceled the production. The only other person it could be was Mr. Brinker Smith, the biologist, but he was a first-floor resident. Owen and I were so quiet, we didn't believe our presence could have been detected from the first floor.
"Nap time," we heard Mr. Brinker Smith say.
Mrs. Brinker Smith giggled. It was instantly apparent to Owen and me that Ginger Brinker-Smith had not brought her husband to this empty room in order to nurse him. The twins were not with them. It was nap time for the twins, too. It strikes me now that the Brinker-Smiths were blessed with good-spirited initiative, with an admirable and inventive sense of mischief. For how else could they have maintained one of the pleasures of conjugal relations without disturbing their demanding twins? At the time, of course, it struck Owen and me that the Brinker-Smiths were dangerously oversexed, that they should make such reckless use of the dormitory beds, including, as we later learned, systematic process through all the rooms of Waterhouse Hall. Well, it was perverse behavior for parents, in Owen's and my view. Day by day, nap by nap, bed by bed, the Brinker-Smiths were working their way to the fourth floor of the dorm. Since Owen and I were working our way to the first floor, it was perhaps inevitable, as Owen would have suggested, and
no coincidence
that we should have encountered the Brinker-Smiths in a second-floor room. I saw nothing, but heard much through the closed closet door. I had never heard Dan with my mother. As usual, Owen Meany had a closer, more intense perception of this passionate event than I had. The Brinker-Smith's clothes fell on both sides of Owen. Ginger Brinker-Smith's legendary nursing bra was tossed within inches of Owen's face. He had to turn his face to the side, Owen told me, in order to avoid the sagging bedspring, which began to make violent, chafing contact with Owen's nose. Even with his face sideways, the bedspring would occasionally plunge near enough to the floor to scrape against his cheek.
"It was the noise that was the worst of it,"
he told me tearfully, after the Brinker-Smiths had returned to their twins.
"I felt like I was underneath the Flying Yankee."
That the Brinker-Smiths were engaged in a far more creative and original use of Waterhouse Hall than Owen and I could make of the old dormitory had a radical effect on the rest of our Christmas vacation. Shocked and battered, Owen suggested we return to the Tamer investigations of 80 Front Street.
"Hardness! Hardness!" Ginger Brinker-Smith had screamed.
"Wetness! Wetness!"
Mr. Brinker-Smith had answered her, and bang, bang, bang beat the bedspring on Owen Meany's head.
"Stupid hardness, stupid wetness,"
Owen complained.
"Sex makes people crazy."
I had only to think of Hester to agree. And so, because of Owen's and my first contact with the act of love, we were at 80 Front Street, just hanging around, the day our mailman, Mr. Morrison, announced his resignation from the role of the ghost of Christmas yet to come.
"Why are you telling me?" my grandmother asked. "I'm not the director."
"Dan ain't on my route," the glum mailman said.
"I don't relay messages of this kind, not even to Dan," my grandmother told Mr. Morrison. "You should go to the next rehearsal and tell Dan yourself."
Grandmother kept the storm door ajar, and the bitter December air must have been cold against her legs. It was plenty cold for Owen and me, and we were positioned deeper into the hall, behind my grandmother, and were both wearing wool flannel trousers. We could feel the chill radiating off Mr. Morrison, who held my grandmother's small bundle of mail in his mittened hand. He appeared reluctant to give her the mail, unless she agreed to carry his message to Dan.
"I ain't setting foot in another of them rehearsals," Mr. Morrison said, shuffling his high-topped boots, shifting his heavy leather sack.
"If you were resigning from the post office, would you ask someone else to tell the postmaster?"
my grandmother asked him. Mr. Morrison considered this. His long face was alternately red and blue from the cold.
"It ain't the part I thought it was," he said to grandmother.
"Tell Dan," grandmother said. "I'm sure I don't know the first thing about it."
"I know about it,"
said Owen Meany. Grandmother regarded Owen uncertainly. Before she allowed him to replace her at the open door, she reached outside and snatched her mail from Mr. Morrison's tentative hand.
"What do you know about it?" the mailman asked Owen.
"It's an important part,"
Owen said. You're the last of the spirits who appear to Scrooge. You're the ghost of the future. You're the scariest ghost of all.
I got nothing to say, Mr. Morrison complained. It ain't even what they call a speaking part.
A great actor doesn't need to talk, Owen said.
I wear this big black cloak with a hood, Mr. Morrison protested. No one can see my face.
There's some justice, anyway, my grandmother said, under her breath to me.
A great actor doesn't need a face, Owen said.
An actor needs something to do, the mailman shouted.
You show Scrooge what will happen to him if he doesn't believe in Christmas, Owen cried. You show a man his own grave. What can be scarier than that?
But all I do is point, Mr. Morrison whined. Nobody would even know what I was pointing at if old Scrooge didn't keep giving speeches to himself. If there is any person in the town who feels emotion caused by this man's death, show that person to me, Spirit, I beseech you. That's the kind of speech old Scrooge is always making, Mr. Morrison shouted. Let me see some tenderness connected with the death, and so on and so forth, the mailman said bitterly. And all I do is point. I got nothing to say, and all anybody sees of me is one finger, Mr. Morrison cried.
He pulled his mitten off and pointed a long, bony finger at Owen Meany, who retreated from the mailman's skeletal hand.
It's a great part for a great actor, Owen said stubbornly. You have to be a presence. There's nothing as scary as the future.
In the hall, behind Owen, an anxious crowd had gathered. Lydia in her wheelchair, Ethel, who was polishing a candlestick, and Germaine, who thought Owen was the devil. They huddled behind my grandmother, who was old enough to take Owen's point of view to heart. Nothing is as scary as the future, she knew, unless it's someone who knows the future. Owen threw up his hand so abruptly that the women were startled and moved away from him.
You know everything yet to come,
he screamed at the disgruntled mailman.
If you walk on stage as if you know the future, I mean everything, you'll scare the shit out of everyone.
Mr. Morrison considered this. There was even a glimmer of comprehension in his gaze, as if he saw, albeit momentarily, his own terrifying potential. But his eyes were quickly fogged over by his breath in the cold air.
Tell Dan I quit, that's all, he said.
Thereupon, the mailman turned and left.
Most undramatically, my grandmother would say later.
At the moment, despite her dislike of vulgar language, grandmother appeared almost charmed by Owen Meany.
Get away from the open door now, Owen, she said. You've given that fool much more attention than he deserves, and you'll catch your death of cold.
I'm calling Dan right away,
Owen told us matter-of-factly. He went directly to the phone and dialed the number. The women and I wouldn't leave the hall, although I think we were all unconscious of how very much we had become his audience.
Hello, Dan, he said into the phone. Dan, this is Owen.
As if there could have been any doubt concerning who it was.
Dan, this is an emergency. You've lost the ghost of Christmas yet to come. Yes, I mean Morrison, the cowardly mailman.
The cowardly mailman, my grandmother repeated admiringly.
Yes, yes, I know he wasn't any good, Owen told Dan. But you don't want to be stuck without a spirit for the future.
That was when I saw it coming, the future, or at least one small part of it. Owen had failed to talk Mr. Morrison into the role, but he had convinced himself it was an important part, far more attractive than being Tiny Tim, that mere goody-goody. Furthermore, it was established that the ghost of Christmas yet to come was not a speaking part. Owen would not have to use his voice, not as the Christ child and not as the ghost of the future.
I don't want you to panic, Dan, Owen said into the phone, because I think I know someone who'd be perfect for the part. Well, if not perfect, at least different.
It was with the word
different
that my grandmother shivered. It was also the first time she looked at Owen Meany with anything resembling respect. Once again, I thought, the little Prince of Peace had taken charge. I looked at Germaine, whose lower lip was captured in her teeth. I knew what she was thinking. Lydia, rocking in her wheelchair, appeared to be mesmerized by the one-sided phone conversation. Ethel held the candlestick like a weapon.
"What the part requires is a certain presence," Owen told Dan. "The ghost must truly appear to know the future. Ironically, the other part I'm playing this Christmas..." "Yes, yes, I mean the stupid pageant. Ironically, this prepares me for the role. I mean, they're both parts that force you to take command of things without words." "Yes, yes, of course I mean me."
There was a rare pause while Owen listened to Dan.
"Who says the ghost of Christmas yet to come has to be tall?"
Owen asked angrily.
"Yes, of course I know how tall Mr. Fish is. Dan, you're not using your imagination."
There was another brief pause, and Owen said,
"There's a simple test. Let me rehearse it. If everybody laughs, I'm out. If everyone is scared, I'm the one." "Yes, of course, including Mr. Fish. Laugh, I'm out. Scared, I'm in."
But I didn't need to wait to know the results of that test. It was necessary only to look at my grandmother's anxious face and at the attitudes of the women surrounding her, at the fear of Owen Meany that was registered by Lydia's transfixed expression, by Ethel's whitened knuckles around the candlestick, by Germaine's trembling lip. It wasn't necessary for me to suspend my belief or disbelief in Owen Meany until after his first rehearsal. I already knew what a presence he could summon, especially in regard to the future. That evening, at dinner, we heard from Dan about Owen's triumph, how the cast stood riveted, not even knowing what dwarf this was, for Owen was completely hidden in the black cloak and hood. It didn't matter that he never spoke or that they couldn't see his face. Not even Mr. Fish had known who the fearful apparition was. As Dickens wrote, "Oh, cold, cold, rigid, dreadful death, set up thine altar here, and dress it with such terrors as thou hast at thy command, for this is thy dominion." Owen had a way of gliding across stage. He several times startled Mr. Fish, who kept losing his sense of where Owen was. When Owen pointed, it was all of a sudden, a convulsive, twitchy movement, his small white hand flashing out of the folds of the cloak, which he flapped. He could glide slowly, like a skater running out of momentum, but he could also skitter with a bat's repellent quickness. At Scrooge's grave, Mr. Fish said, "Before I draw nearer to that stone to which you point, answer me one question. Are these the shadows of the things that will be, or are they shadows of the things that may be only?" As never before, this question seemed to seize the attention of every amateur among the Gravesend players. Even Mr. Fish appeared to be mortally interested in the answer. But the midget ghost of Christmas yet to come was inexorable. The tiny phantom's indifference to the question made Dan Needham shiver. It was then that Mr. Fish approached close enough to the gravestone to read his own name thereon. "Ebenezer Scrooge, am I that man?" Mr. Fish cried, falling to his knees. It was from the perspective of his knees, when Mr. Fish's head was only slightly above Owen Meany's, that Mr. Fish received his first full look at the averted face under the hood. Mr. Fish did not laugh. He screamed. He was supposed to say, "No, spirit, oh no, no, spirit, hear me, I am not the man I was," and so on and so forth, but Mr. Fish simply screamed. He pulled his hands so fiercely away from Owen's cowl that the hood was yanked off Owen's head, revealing him to the other members of the cast. Several of them screamed, too. No one laughed.
"It makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up, just to remember it," Dan told us over dinner.
"I'm not surprised," my grandmother said.
After dinner, Mr. Fish made a somewhat subdued appearance.
"Well, at least we've got one good ghost," Mr. Fish said. "It makes my job a lot easier, really," he rationalized.
"The little fellow is quite effective, quite effective. It will be interesting to see his effect on an audience."
"We've already seen it," Dan reminded him.
"Well, yes," Mr. Fish agreed hastily. He looked worried.
"Someone told me that Mr. Early's daughter wet her pants," Dan informed us.
"I'm not surprised," my grandmother said.
Germaine, clearing one teaspoon at a time, appeared ready to wet hers.
"Perhaps you might hold him back a little," Mr. Fish suggested to Dan.
"Hold him back?" Dan asked.
"Well, get him to restrain whatever it is he does," Mr. Fish said.
"I'm not at all sure what it is he does," Dan said.
"I'm not either," Mr. Fish said. "It's just so disturbing."
"Perhaps when people are sitting back a few rows in the audience, I mean, it won't be quite so upsetting," Dan said.
"Do you think so?"
Mr. Fish asked.
"Not really," Dan admitted.
"What if we saw his face from the beginning?" Mr. Fish suggested.
"If you don't pull his hood off, we'll never see his face," Dan pointed out to Mr. Fish.
"I think that will be better."
"Yes, much better,"
Mr. Fish agreed.
Mr. Meany dropped Owen off at 80 Front Street so he could spend the night. Mr. Meany knew that my grandmother resented the racket his truck made in the driveway. That was why we didn't hear him come and go. He let Owen out of the cab on Front Street.
It was quite magical. I mean, the timing. Mr. Fish sang goodnight, opening the door to leave, precisely at the same time as Owen was reaching to ring the doorbell. My grandmother, at that instant, turned on the porch light. Owen blinked into the light. From under his red and black checkered hunter's cap, his small, sharp face stared up at Mr. Fish, like the face of a possum caught in a flashlight. A dull, yellowish bruise, the sheen of tarnished silver, marked Owen's cheek, where the Brinker Smith's mobile bed had struck him, giving him a cadaver's uneven color. Mr. Fish leaped backward into the hall.
"Speak of the devil," Dan said, smiling.
Owen smiled back at us all.
"I guess you heard. I got the part,"
he said to my grandmother and me.
"I'm not surprised, Owen," my grandmother said. "Won't you come in?"
She actually held the door open for him. She even managed a charming curtsy, inappropriately girlish, but Harriet Wheelwright was gifted with those essentially regal properties that make the inappropriate gesture work, those being facetiousness and sarcasm. Owen Meany did not miss the irony in my grandmother's voice, yet he beamed at her, and he returned her curtsy with a confident bow and with a little tip of his red and black checkered hunter's cap. Owen had triumphed, and he knew it. My grandmother knew it, too. Even Harriet Wheelwright, with her Mayflower indifference toward the meanies of this world, even my grandmother knew that there was more to the granite mouse than met the eye. Mr. Fish, perhaps to compose himself, was humming the tune to a familiar Christmas carol. Even Dan Needham knew the words. As Owen finished knocking the snow off his boots, as the little Lord Jesus stepped inside our house, Dan half sang, half mumbled the refrain we knew so well.
"Hark the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King."
Chapter 5 The Ghost of the Future. Thus did Owen Meany remodel Christmas. denied his long-sought excursion to Sawyer Depot, he captured the two most major non-speaking roles in the only dramatic productions offered in Gravesend that holiday season. As the Christ Child and as the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, he had established himself as a prophet. Disquietingly, it was our future he seemed to know something about. Once, he thought, he had seen into my mother's future. He had even become an instrument of her future. I wondered what he thought he knew of Dan's or my grandmother's future, or Hester's or mine, or his own. God would tell me who my father was, Owen Meany had assured me, but so far, God had been silent. It was Owen who'd been talkative. He'd talked Dan and me out of the dressmaker's dummy. He'd stationed my mother's heartbreaking figure at his bedside to stand watch over him, to be his angel. Owen had talked himself down from the heavens and into the manger. He'd made me a Joseph. He'd chosen a Mary for me. He'd turned turtle doves to cows. Having revised the Holy Nativity, he had moved on. He was reinterpreting Dickens. For even Dan had to admit that Owen had somehow changed A Christmas Carol. The silent ghost of Christmas Yet to Come had stolen the penultimate scene from Scrooge. Even the Gravesend newsletter failed to recognize that Scrooge was the main character. That Mr. Fish was the principal actor was a fact that entirely eluded the newsletter's drama critic, who wrote, "The quintessential Christmas tale, the luster of which has been dulled, at least for this reviewer, by its annual repetition, has been given a new sparkle." The critic added, "The shop-worn ghost story part of the tale has been energized by the brilliant performance of little Owen Meany, who, despite his diminutive size, is a huge presence on stage. The miniature Meany simply dwarfs the other performers. Director Dan Needham should consider casting the Tiny Tim-sized star as Scrooge in next year's A Christmas Carol." There was not a word about this year's Scrooge, and Mr. Fish fumed over his neglect. Owen responded crossly to any criticism.
"Why is it necessary to refer to me as little, as diminutive, as miniature?" Owen raved. "They don't make such qualifying remarks about the other actors."
"You forgot Tiny Tim-sized," I told him.
I know, he said. "Do they say former dog owner Fish is a superb Scrooge? Do they say vicious Sunday school tyrant Walker makes a charming mother for Tiny Tim?"
"They called you a star," I reminded him. "They called you brilliant and a huge presence."
"They called me little. They called me diminutive. They called me miniature,"
Owen cried. "It's a good thing it wasn't a speaking part," I reminded him.
"Very funny," Owen said.
In the case of this particular production, Dan wasn't bothered by the local press. What troubled Dan was what Charles Dickens might have thought of Owen Meany. Dan was sure that Dickens would have disapproved. "Something's not right," Dan said. "Small children burst into tears. They have to be removed from the audience before they get to the happy ending. We've started warning mothers with small children at the door. It's not quite the family entertainment it's supposed to be. Kids leave the theater looking like they've seen Dracula." Dan was relieved to observe, however, that Owen appeared to be coming down with a cold. Owen was susceptible to colds, and now he was overtired all the time, rehearsing the Holy Nativity in the mornings, performing as the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come at night. Some afternoons, Owen was so exhausted that he fell asleep at my grandmother's house. He would drop off to sleep on the rug in the den, lying under the big couch or on a stack of the couch pillows, where he'd been gunning down my metal soldiers with my toy cannon. I would go to the kitchen to get us some cookies, and when I came back to the den, Owen would be fast asleep.
"He's getting to be like Lydia,"
my grandmother observed, because Lydia could not stay awake in the afternoons either. She would nod off to sleep in her wheelchair, wherever Germaine had left her, sometimes facing into a corner. This was a further indication to my grandmother that Lydia's senility was in advance of her own. But as Owen began to manifest the early signs of the common cold, a sneeze or a cough now and then and a runny nose, Dan Needham imagined that his production of A Christmas Carol might be the beneficiary of Owen getting sick. Dan didn't want Owen to be ill. It was just a small cough and a sneeze, and maybe even Owen having to blow his nose that Dan was wishing for. Such a human noise from under the dark hood would surely put the audience at ease. Owen sneezing and snorting might even draw a laugh or two. In Dan's opinion, a laugh or two wouldn't hurt. "It might hurt Owen," I pointed out. "I don't think Owen would appreciate any laughter." "I don't mean that I want to make the Ghost of the Future a comic character," Dan maintained. "I would just like to humanize him a little." For that was the problem, in Dan's view. Owen did not look human. He was the size of a small child, but his movements were uncannily adult, and his authority on stage was beyond adult. It was supernatural. "Look at it this way," Dan said to me. "A ghost who sneezes, a ghost who coughs, a ghost who has to blow his nose. He's just not quite so scary." "But what about a Christ child who sneezes and coughs and has to blow his nose?" I thought. If the Wiggins insisted that the baby Jesus couldn't cry, what would they think of a sick Prince of Peace? Everyone was sick that Christmas. Dan got over bronchitis only to discover he had pink eye. Lydia had such a violent cough that she would occasionally propel herself backward in her wheelchair. When Mr. Early, who was Marley's ghost, began to hack and sniffle, Dan confided to me that it would be perfect symmetry for the play if all the ghosts came down with something. Mr. Fish, who had by far the most lines, pampered himself so that he wouldn't catch anyone else's cold. Thus, Scrooge retreated from Marley's ghost in an even more exaggerated fashion. Grandmother complained that the weather was too slippery for her to go out. She was not worried about colds, but she dreaded falling on the ice. "At my age," she told me, "it's one fall, one broken hip, and then a long, slow death from pneumonia." Lydia coughed and nodded and coughed, but neither woman would share her elderly wisdom with me concerning why a broken hip produced pneumonia, not to mention a long, slow death.
"But you have to see Owen in A Christmas Carol," I said.
"I see quite enough of Owen," Grandmother told me.
"Mr. Fish is also quite good," I said.
"I see quite enough of Mr. Fish, too," Grandmother remarked.
The rave review that Owen received from the Gravesend newsletter appeared to drive Mr. Fish into a silent depression. When he came to 80 Front Street after dinner, he sighed often and said nothing. As for our morose mailman, Mr. Morrison, it is incalculable how much he suffered to hear of Owen's success. He stooped under his leather sack as if he shouldered a burden much more demanding than the excess of Christmas mail. How did it make him feel to deliver all those copies of the Gravesend newsletter wherein Mr. Morrison's former role was described as not only pivotal but principal? And Owen Meany was showered with the kind of praise Mr. Morrison might have imagined for himself. In the first week, Dan told me, Mr. Morrison did not come to watch the production. To Dan's surprise, Mr. and Mrs. Meany had not made an appearance either. "Don't they read the newsletter?" Dan asked me. I could not imagine Mrs. Meany reading. The demands on her time were too severe. With all her staring at walls, into corners, not quite out the window, into the dying fire, at my mother's dummy, when would Mrs. Meany have the time to read a newspaper? And Mr. Meany was not even one of those men who read about sports. I imagine, too, that the Meanys would never have heard about A Christmas Carol from Owen. After all, he hadn't wanted them to know about the pageant. Perhaps one of the quarrymen would say something about the play to Mr. Meany. Maybe a stonecutter or the derrickman's wife had seen it, or at least read about it in the newsletter. "Here you boys, the star of the theater," someone might say. But I could hear, too, how Owen would dismiss it.
"I'm just helping Dan out. He got in a fix. One of the ghosts quit. You know Morrison, the cowardly mailman? Well, it was a case of stage fright. It's a very small part, not even a speaking part. I wouldn't recommend the play, either. It's not very believable, and besides, you never get to see my face. I don't think I'm on stage for more than 5 minutes."
I was sure that was how Owen would have handled it. I thought he was excessively proud of himself, and that he treated his parents harshly. We all go through a phase, it lasts a lifetime for some of us, when we're embarrassed by our parents. We don't want them hanging around us because we're afraid they'll do or say something that will make us feel ashamed of them. But Owen seemed to me to suffer this embarrassment more than most. That's why I thought he held his parents at such a great distance from himself, and he was, in my opinion, exceedingly bossy toward his father. At an age when most of our peers were enduring how much their parents bossed them around, Owen was always telling his father what to do. My sympathy for Owen's embarrassment was slight. After all, I missed my mother. I would have enjoyed her hanging around me. Because Dan wasn't my real father, I had never developed any resentment toward Dan. I always loved having Dan around. My grandmother, although she was a loving grandmother, was aloof. "Owen," Dan said one evening, "would you like me to invite your parents to see the play? Maybe for our last performance on Christmas Eve?"
"I think they're busy on Christmas Eve," Owen said.
"How about one of the earlier evenings, then?" Dan asked. "Some evening soon. Shall I invite them? Any evening would be fine."
"They're not exactly theater-going types," Owen said. "I don't mean to insult you, Dan, but I'm afraid my parents would be bored."
"But surely they'd enjoy seeing you, Owen," Dan said. "Wouldn't they like your performance?"
"The only stories they like are true stories," Owen said. "They're rather realistic. They don't get too excited about made-up stories. Anything that's sort of make-believe, that's not for them. And anything with ghosts, that's out."
"Ghosts are out?" Dan asked.
"All that kind of stuff is out, with them," Owen said.
But listening to him, I found I had just the opposite impression of his parents. I thought that Owen Meany's mother and father believed only in the so-called make-believe, that ghosts were all they believed in, that spirits were all they listened to.
"What I mean is, Dan,"
Owen said,
"is that I'd rather not invite my parents. If they come, okay, but I think they won't."
"Sure, sure," Dan said. "Anything you say, Owen." Dan Needham suffered from my mother's affliction. He, too, couldn't keep his hands off Owen Meany. Dan was not a hair-messer, not a patter of butts or shoulders. Dan grabbed your hands and mashed them, sometimes until your knuckles and his cracked together. But Dan's manifestations of physical affection for Owen exceeded even his fondness for me. Dan had the good instincts to keep his distance from me, to be like a father to me, but not to assert himself too exactly in the role. Because of a physical caution that Dan expressed when he touched me, he was less restrained with Owen, whose father never once, at least not in my presence, touched him. I think Dan Needham knew, too, that Owen was not ever handled at home. There was a fourth curtain call on Saturday night, and Dan sent Owen out on stage alone. It was apparent that the audience wanted Owen alone. Mr. Fish had already been out on stage with Owen and by himself. It was clearly Owen whom the crowd adored. The audience rose to greet him. The peak of his death-black hood was a trifle pointy and too tall for Owen's small head. It had flopped over to one side, giving Owen a gnomish appearance and a slightly cocky, puckish attitude. When he flipped the hood back and showed the audience his beaming face, a young girl in one of the front rows fainted. She was about our age, maybe 12 or 13, and she dropped down like a sack of grain.
"It was quite warm where we were sitting," the girl's mother said, after Dan made sure the girl had recovered.
"Stupid girl,"
Owen said backstage. He was his own makeup man. Even though his face remained concealed throughout his performance by the overlarge floppy hood, he whitened his face with baby powder and blackened the already dark sockets under his eyes with eyeliner. He wanted even the merest glimpse that the audience might get of him to be properly ghostly. That his cold was worsening enhanced the pallor he desired.
He was coughing pretty regularly by the time Dan drove him home. The last Sunday before Christmas, the day of our pageant, was tomorrow. "He sounds a little sicker than I had in mind," Dan told me on our way back to town. "I may have to play the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come myself. Or maybe, if Owen's too sick, maybe you can take the part." But I was just a Joseph. I felt that Owen Meany had already chosen me for the only part I could play. It snowed overnight, not a major storm. Then the temperature kept dropping until it was too cold to snow. A new coat of flat white, flatter than church white, lay spread over Gravesend that Sunday morning. The wind, which is the cruelest kind of cold, kicked up wisps and kite tails of the dry powder and made the empty rain gutters at 80 Front Street rattle and moan. The gutters were empty because the new snow was too cold to cling. The snow plows were in no hurry to be early on Sunday mornings, and the only vehicle that didn't slip and skid as it made its way up Front Street was the heavy truck from the Meany Granite Company. Owen had so many clothes on, he had difficulty bending his knees as he trudged up the driveway, and his arms did not swing close to his sides but protruded stiffly like the limbs of a scarecrow. He was so muffled up in a long, dark green scarf that I couldn't see his face at all. But who could ever mistake Owen Meany for anyone else? It was a scarf my mother had given him when she'd discovered one winter that he didn't own one. Owen called it his lucky scarf, and he saved it for important occasions or for when it was especially cold. The last Sunday before Christmas called for my mother's scarf on both counts. As Owen and I tramped down Front Street toward Christchurch, the birds took flight at Owen's barking cough. There was a phlegmy rattle in his chest, loud enough for me to hear through his many layers of winter clothes.
"You don't sound very well, Owen,"
I pointed out to him.
"If Jesus had to be born on a day like this, I don't think he'd have lasted long enough to be crucified,"
Owen said. On Front Street's almost virgin sidewalk, only one set of footprints had broken the snow before us. Except for the clumsy peeing of dogs, the sidewalk was an unmarred path of white. The figure who had made the morning's first human tracks in the snow was too bundled up and too far ahead of Owen and me for us to recognize him.
"Your grandmother isn't coming to the pageant?"
Owen asked me.
"She's a Congregationalist," I reminded him. "But is she so inflexible that she can't switch churches for one Sunday of the year? The Congregationalists don't have a pageant."
I know, I said. But I knew more than that. I knew the Congregationalists didn't have the conventional morning service on the last Sunday before Christmas. They had Vespers instead. It was a special event, largely for caroling. It wasn't that my grandmother's church service was in conflict with our pageant. It was that grandmother was not enticed to see Owen play the Christ child. She had remarked that she found the idea repulsive. Also, she made such a fuss about the weather's potential for breaking her hip that she announced her intention to skip the Vespers at the Congregational Church. By the later afternoon, when the light was gone, it was even easier, she reasoned, to break your hip on the ice in the dark. The man on the sidewalk ahead of us was Mr. Fish, whom we rather quickly caught up to. Mr. Fish was making his unreckless way with absurdly great care. He must have feared breaking his hip, too. He was startled by the sight of Owen Meany, wrapped up so tightly in my mother's scarf that only Owen's eyes were showing. But Mr. Fish was often startled to see Owen. "Why aren't you already at the church getting into your costumes?" he asked us. We pointed out that we would be almost an hour early. Even at the rate Mr. Fish was walking, he would be half an hour early. But Owen and I were surprised that Mr. Fish was attending the pageant.
"You're not a churchgoer,"
Owen said accusingly. "Why, no, I'm not, that's true," Mr. Fish admitted. "But I wouldn't miss this for the world." Owen eyed his co-star in A Christmas Carol cautiously. Mr. Fish seemed both so depressed and impressed by Owen's success that his attendance at the Christchurch Christmas pageant was suspicious.
I suspect that Mr. Fish enjoyed depressing himself. Also, he was so slavishly devoted to amateur acting that he desperately sought to pick up as many pointers as he could by observing Owen's genius.
"I may not be at my best today,"
Owen warned Mr. Fish. He then demonstrated his barking cough, dramatically. "A trooper like you is surely undaunted by a little illness, Owen," Mr. Fish observed. We three trudged through the snow together, Mr. Fish coming halfway to meet us on the matter of pace. He confided to Owen and me that he was a little nervous about attending church, that he'd never once been forced to go to church when he was a child. His parents had not been religious either, and that he'd only set foot in churches for weddings and funerals. Mr. Fish wasn't even sure how much of Christ's story A Christmas Pageant covered.
"Not the whole thing,"
Owen told him. "Not the bit on the cross?" Mr. Fish asked.
"They didn't nail him to the cross when he was a baby,"
Owen said. "How about the bit when he does all the healing and all the lecturing to the disciples?" Mr. Fish asked.
"It doesn't go past Christmas,"
Owen said with exasperation.
"It's just the birthday scene."
"It's not a speaking part," I reminded Mr. Fish.
"Oh, of course. I forgot about that," Mr. Fish said. Christchurch was on Elliott Street, at the edge of the Gravesend Academy campus. At the corner of Elliott and Front Streets, Dan Needham was waiting for us. Apparently, the director intended to pick up a few pointers, too.
"My, my, look who's here," Dan said to Mr. Fish, who blushed.
Owen was cheered to see that Dan was coming.
"It's a good thing you're here, Dan,"
Owen told him,
"because this is Mr. Fish's first Christmas pageant, and he's a little nervous."
"I'm just not sure when to genuflect and all that nonsense," Mr. Fish said, chuckling.
"Not all Episcopalians genuflect,"
Owen announced.
"I don't," I said.
"I do,"
said Owen Meany.
"Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't," Dan said. "When I'm in church, I watch the other people. I do what they do."
Thus did our eclectic foursome arrive at Christchurch. Despite the cold, the Reverend Dudley Wiggin was standing outdoors on the church steps to greet the early arrivals. He was not wearing a hat, and his scalp glowed a howling red under his thin gray hair. His ears looked frozen, bloodless enough to break off. Barb Wiggin stood in a silver fur coat beside him, wearing a matching fur hat.
"She looks like a stewardess on the Trans-Siberian Railroad,"
Owen observed. I got quite a shock to see the Reverend Lewis Merrill and his California wife standing next to the Wiggins. Owen was surprised, too.
"Have you changed churches?"
Owen asked them. The long-suffering Merrills appeared not to possess the imaginative capacity to know what Owen meant. It was a question that raised havoc with Mr. Merrill's usually slight stutter.
"We have vespers today,"
Mr. Merrill told Owen, who didn't understand.
"The Congregationalists have a vesper service today," I told Owen. "Instead of the regular morning service," I added. "Vespers are in the late afternoon."
"I know what time vespers are,"
Owen answered irritably. The Reverend Mr. Wiggin put his arm around his fellow clergyman's shoulder, giving the Reverend Mr. Merrill such a squeeze that the smaller, paler man looked alarmed. I believe that Episcopalians are generally heartier than Congregationalists.
"Barb and I go to the Vespers for the caroling every year," Rector Wiggin announced. "And the Merrills come to our pageant."
"Every year,"
Mrs. Merrill added neutrally. She looked miserably envious of Owen's face-concealing scarf. The Reverend Mr. Merrill composed himself. I'd not seen him so tongue-tied since Sagamore's spontaneous funeral, and it occurred to me that it might be Owen who so effectively crippled his speech.
"We really go in for the caroling. We celebrate the songs of Christmas. We've always put great emphasis on our choir,"
Pastor Merrill said. He appeared to single me out for a heartfelt look when he said choir, as if the mere mention of these trained angels was certain to remind me of my mother's lost voice.
"We go in more for the miracle itself,"
said Mr. Wiggin joyfully. And this year, the rector added, suddenly taking a grip of Owen's shoulder with his steady pilot's hand, this year we've got a little Lord Jesus who's gonna take your breath away. The Reverend Dudley Wiggin mauled Owen's head in his big paw, managing to push down the visor of Owen's red and black checkered hunter's cap. At the same time, he effectively blinded Owen by scrunching up my mother's lucky scarf. Yes, sir, said Rector Wiggin, who now lifted the hunter's cap off Owen's head so quickly that static electricity caused Owen's silky thin, baby-like hair to stand up and wave in all directions. This year, Captain Wiggin warned, there's not going to be a dry eye in the house. Owen, who appeared to be strangling in his scarf, sneezed.
Owen, you come with me, Barb Wiggin said sharply. I've got to wrap this poor child in his swaddling clothes before he catches cold, she explained to the Merrills. But Mr. Merrill and his shivering wife looked in need of being wrapped in swaddling clothes themselves. They seemed aghast at the notion that Owen Meany was cast as the Prince of Peace. The Congregationalists are a lot less miracle-oriented than the Episcopalians, I believe. In the chilly vestibule of the parish house, Barb Wiggin proceeded to imprison Owen Meany in the swaddling clothes, but however tightly or loosely she bound him in the broad cotton swathes, Owen complained.
"It's too tight! I can't breathe!" he would say, coughing,
or else he would cry out,
"I feel a draft!"
Barb Wiggin worked over him with such a grim, humorless sense of purpose that you would have thought she was embalming him. Perhaps that's what she thought of as she swaddled him, to calm herself. The combination of being so roughly handled by Barb Wiggin and discovering that my grandmother had been free to attend the pageant, but had chosen not to attend, was deleterious to Owen's mood. He grew cranky and petulant. He insisted that he be unswaddled and then re-swaddled in my mother's
lucky
scarf. When this was accomplished, the white cotton swathes could be wrapped over the scarf to conceal it. The point being, he wanted the scarf next to his skin.
For warmth and for luck, he said.
The baby Jesus doesn't need luck, Owen, Barb Wiggin told him.
Are you telling me Christ was lucky?
Owen asked her.
I would say he could have used a little more luck than he had. I would say he ran out of luck at the end.
But Owen, Rector Wiggin said, he was crucified, yet he rose from the dead. He was resurrected. Isn't the point that he was saved?
He was used, said Owen Meany,
who was in a contrary mood. The rector appeared to consider whether the time was right for ecclesiastical debate. Barb Wiggin appeared to consider throttling Owen with my mother's scarf. That Christ was lucky or unlucky, that he was saved or used, seemed rather serious points of difference, even in the hurried-up atmosphere of the parish house vestibule, drafty from the opening and closing of the outside door and at the same time smelling of steam from the wet woolen clothes that dripped melting snow into the heat registers. Yet who was a mere rector of Christ Church to argue with the babe in swaddling clothes about to lie in a manger?
Wrap him up the way he likes it, Mr. Wiggin instructed his wife.
But there was menace in his tone, as if the rector were weighing the possibilities of Owen Meany being the Christ or the Antichrist. With the fury of the strokes with which she unwrapped him and rewrapped him, Barb Wiggin demonstrated that Owen was no Prince of Peace to her. The cows, the former turtle doves, were staggering around the crowded vestibule as if made restless by the absence of hay. Mary Beth Baird looked quite lush, like a slightly plump starlet in her white raiment, but both the Holy Mother effect and the Holy Virgin effect were undermined by her long, rakish pigtail. As a typical Joseph, I was attired in a dull brown robe, the biblical equivalent of a three-piece suit. Harold Crosby, delaying his ascension in the often faulty angel apparatus, had twice requested a last visit to the men's room. Swaddled as he was, it was a good thing, I thought, that Owen didn't have to pee. He couldn't stand, and even if he'd been propped up on his feet, he couldn't have walked.
Barb Wigan had wrapped his legs too tightly together. That was the first problem, how to get him to the creche, so that our creative assembly could gather out of sight of the congregation. A tripartite screen had been placed in front of the rude manger. A gold brocade cross adorned each purple panel of the triptych. We were supposed to take our places behind this altarpiece, to freeze there in photographic stillness, and as the announcing angel began his harrowing descent to the shepherds, thus distracting the congregation from us, the purple screen would be removed. The pillar of light, following the shepherds and kings, would lead the congregation's rapt attention to our assembly in the stable. Naturally, Mary Beth Baird wanted to carry Owen to the creche.
"I can do it,"
the Virgin Mother proclaimed. "I've lifted him up before."
"No, Joseph carries the baby Jesus,"
Owen cried, beseeching me. But Barb Wigan wished to undertake the task herself. Observing that the Christ child's nose was running, she deftly wiped it. Then she held the handkerchief in place while instructing him to blow. He blew an inhuman little honk. Mary Beth Baird was provided with a clean handkerchief in case the baby Jesus's nose became offensive while he lay in view in the manger. The Virgin Mother was delighted to have been given a physical responsibility for Owen. Before she lifted the little Prince of Peace in her arms, Barb Wigan bent over him and massaged his cheeks. There was a curious combination of the perfunctory and the erotic in her attentions to Owen Meany. Naturally, I saw something so stewardess-like in her performance of these duties, as if she were dispatching with Owen in the manner that she might have changed a diaper, while at the same time there was something salacious in how close she put her face to his, as if she were intent on seducing him. "You're too pale," she told him, actually pinching color into Owen's face.
"Ow!"
he said. "The baby Jesus should be apple-cheeked," she told him. She bent even closer to him and touched the tip of her nose to his nose. Quite unexpectedly, she kissed him on the mouth. It was not a tender, affectionate kiss. It was a cruel, teasing kiss that startled Owen. He flushed. He turned the rosy complexion Barb Wigan had desired. Tears sprang to his eyes. "I know you don't like to be kissed, Owen," Barb Wigan told him flirtatiously, "but that's for good luck. That's all that's for." I knew it was the first time Owen had been kissed on the mouth since my mother had kissed him. That Barb Wigan might have reminded him of my mother, I'm sure, outraged him. He clenched his fists at his sides as Barb Wigan lifted him, stiffly prone, to her breasts. His legs, too tightly swaddled to bend at the knees, stuck out straight. He appeared to be a successful levitation experiment in the arms of a harlot magician. Mary Beth Baird, who had once pleaded to be allowed to kiss the baby Jesus, glared with jealous loathing at Barb Wigan, who must have been an exceptionally strong stewardess in her time in the sky. She had no difficulty carrying Owen to his prepared place in the hay. She bore him easily against her breasts, with the stern sense of ceremony of a foxy mortician, bearing a child pharaoh into the pyramid's hidden tomb. "Relax, relax," she whispered to him. She put her mouth wickedly close to his ear, and he blushed rosier and rosier. And I, Joseph, forever standing in the wings, saw what the envious Virgin Mary failed to see. I saw it, and I'm sure Barb Wigan saw it, too. I'm sure it was why she so shamelessly continued to torture him. The baby Jesus had an erection. Its protrusion was visible in spite of the tightly bound layers of his swaddling clothes. Barb Wigan laid him in the manger. She smiled knowingly at him, and gave him one more saucy peck on his rosy cheek, for good luck, no doubt. This was not of the nature of a Christ-like lesson for Owen Meany, to learn, as he lay in the manger, that someone you hate can give you a hard-on. Anger and shame flushed Owen's face. Mary Beth Baird, misunderstanding the baby Jesus' expression, wiped his nose. A cow trod on an angel, who nearly toppled the tripartite purple screen. The hind part of a donkey was nudged by the teetering triptych. I stared into the darkness of the mock flying buttresses for some reassuring glimpse of the announcing angel, but Harold Crosby was invisible. He was hidden, doubtless in fear and trembling, above the pillar of light.
"Blow!"
Mary Beth Baird whispered to Owen, who looked ready to explode. It was the choir that saved him. There was a metallic clicking, like the teeth of a ratchet, as the mechanism for lowering the angel began its task. This was followed by a brief gasp, the panicked intake of Harold Crosby's breath, as the choir began.
O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by.
Only gradually did the baby Jesus unclench his fists. Only slowly did the Christ child's erection subside. The glint of anger in Owen's eyes was dulled, as if by an inspired drowsiness. A trance of peace blessed the little prince's expression, which brought tears of adoration to the already moist eyes of the Holy Mother.
"Blow! Why won't you blow?"
she whispered plaintively. Mary Beth Baird held the handkerchief to his nose, managing to cover his mouth, too, as if she were administering an anesthetic. With grace, with gentleness, Owen pushed her hand and the handkerchief aside. His smile forgave her everything, even her clumsiness, and the Blessed Virgin tottered a trifle on her knees, as if she were preparing to swoon. Hidden from the congregation's view, but ominously visible to us, Barb Wiggins seized the controls of the angel-lowering apparatus like a heavy equipment operator about to attack the terra firma with a backhoe. When Owen caught her eye, she appeared to lose her confidence and her poise. The look he gave her was both challenging and lascivious. A shudder coursed through Barb Wiggins' body. She gave a corresponding jerk of her shoulders, distracting her from her task. Harold Crosby's meant-to-be-stately descent to Earth was momentarily suspended.
"Be not afraid,"
Harold Crosby began, his voice quaking. But I, Joseph, I saw someone who was afraid. Barb Wiggin, frozen at the controls of the Pillar of Light, arrested in her duties with the angel-lowering apparatus, was afraid of Owen Meany. The Prince of Peace had regained his control. He had made a small but important discovery. A hard-on comes and goes. The Pillar of Light, which was supposed to follow Harold Crosby's now interrupted risky descent, appeared to have a will of its own. It illuminated Owen on the mountain of hay, as if the light had wrested control of itself from Barb Wiggin. The light that was supposed to reveal the angel bathed the manger instead. From the congregation, as the janitor tiptoed out of sight with the tripartite screen, there arose a single murmur, but the Christ child quieted them with the slightest movement of his hand. He directed a most unbaby-like, sardonic look at Barb Wiggin, who only then regained her control. She moved the pillar of light back to the descending angel, where it belonged.
"Be not afraid,"
Harold Crosby repeated. Barb Wiggin, a tad eager at the controls of the angel-lowering apparatus, dropped him suddenly. It was about a 10-foot freefall before she abruptly halted his descent. His head was jerked and snapped all around with his mouth open, and he swung back and forth above the frightened shepherds like a giant gull toying with the wind.
"Be not afraid!"
Harold cried loudly. There he paused, swinging. He was stalling. He had forgotten the rest of his lines. Barb Wiggin, trying to prevent the angel from swinging, turned Harold Crosby away from the shepherds and the congregation, so that he continued to swing, but with his back toward everyone, as if he had decided to spurn the world or retract his message.
"Be not afraid,"
he mumbled indistinctly. From the hay in the dark came the cracked falsetto, the ruined voice of an unlikely prompter. But who else would know, by heart, the lines that Harold Crosby had forgotten? Who else but the former announcing angel?
"For behold, I bring you good news of a great joy which will come to all the people,"
Owen whispered. But Owen Meany couldn't really whisper. His voice had too much sand and gravel in it. Not only Harold Crosby heard the Christ child's prompting, every member of the congregation heard it too. The strained, holy voice speaking from the darkened manger, telling the angel what to say. Dutifully, Harold repeated the lines he was given. Thus, when the pillar of light finally followed the shepherds and kings to their proper place of worship at the creche, the congregation was also prepared to adore him. Whatever special Christ this was, who not only knew his role but also knew all the other vital parts of the story. Mary Beth Baird was overcome. Her face flopped first on the hay, then her cheek bumped the baby Jesus' hip. Then she lunged further into prostration, actually putting her heavy head in Owen's lap. The pillar of light trembled at this shameless, unmotherly behavior. Barb Wiggins' fury and her keen anticipation of worse to come suggested the intensity of someone in command of a machine gun nest. She struggled to hold the light steady. I was aware that Barb Wiggin had cranked Harold Crosby up so high that he was completely gone from view, up in the dark dust, up in the gloom, inspired by the mock flying buttresses. Harold Crosby, who was still probably facing the wrong way, was flapping like a stranded bat. But I couldn't see him. I had only a vague impression of his panic and his helplessness. "I love thee, Lord Jesus, look down from the sky, and stay by my cradle till morning is nigh," sang the choir, thus wrapping up Away in a Manger. The Reverend Dudley Wiggin was a little slow starting with Luke. Perhaps it had occurred to him that the Virgin Mary was supposed to wait until after the reading before bowing to the baby Jesus. Now that Mary Beth's head was already stationed in Owen's lap, the rector might have feared what Mary Beth would think was an appropriate substitute for bowing. "When the angel went away from them into heaven," the rector began. The congregation automatically searched the ceiling for Harold Crosby. In the front pews of faces that I observed, no one sought the disappearing angel with as much fervor as Mr. Fish, who was already surprised to hear that Owen Meany did have a speaking part. Owen looked ready to sneeze, or else the weight of Mary Beth's head was restricting his breathing. His nose, unwiped and unblown, had dribbled two shiny rivulets across his upper lip. I could see that he was sweating. It was such a cold day. The old church furnace was throwing out the heat full tilt. The raised altar area was a lot warmer than the wooden pews, where many of the congregation still wore their outdoor clothes. The heat in the manger was stifling. I pitied the donkeys and the cows inside their costumes. They had to be perspiring. The pillar of light felt hot enough to ignite the hay where the baby Jesus lay pinned by the Holy Mother. We were still listening to the reading from Luke when the first donkey fainted. Actually, it was only the hind part of a donkey that fainted, so that the effect of the collapse was quite startling. Many of the congregation were unaware that donkeys came in two parts. The way the donkey crumbled must have been even more alarming to them. It appeared that a donkey's hind legs gave way under him, while the forelegs struggled to remain standing, and the head and neck surged this way and that for balance. The donkey's ass and hind legs simply dropped to the floor, as if the beast had suffered a selective stroke or had been shot. Its rump was paralyzed. The front half of the donkey made a game effort, but was soon dragged down after its disabled parts. A cow, blinded by its horns and trying to avoid the falling donkey, butted a shepherd into and over the low communion railing. The shepherd struck the kneeling cushions a glancing blow and rolled into the center aisle by the first row of pews. When the second donkey dropped, the Reverend Mr. Wiggin read faster.
But Mary kept all these things, the rector said, pondering them in her heart.
The Virgin Mary lifted her head from the Christ child's lap, a mystical grin upon her flushed face. She thumped both hands to her heart, as if an arrow or a lance had run her through from behind, and her eyes rolled toward her shining forehead as if, even before she could fall, she were giving up the ghost. The baby Jesus, suddenly anxious about the direction and force of Mother Mary's swoon, reached out his arms to catch her, but Owen was not strong enough to support Mary Beth Baird. Chest to chest, she pressed him into the hay, where they appeared to be wrestling. And I, Joseph, I saw how the little Lord Jesus got his mother off him. He goosed her. It was a fast attack, concealed in a flurry of flying hay. You had to be a Joseph or Barb Wiggin to know what happened. What the congregation saw was the Holy Mother roll out of the hay pile and across the floor of the manger, where she collected herself at a safe distance from the unpredictable Prince of Peace. Owen withered Mary Beth with a look as scornful as the look he'd shown Barb Wiggin. It was the same look he then delivered to the congregation, oblivious to, if not contemptuous of, the gifts the wise men and the shepherds laid at his feet. Like a commanding officer reviewing his troops, the Christ child surveyed the congregation. The faces I could see, in the frontmost pews, appeared to be tensing for rejection. Mr. Fish's face and Dan's face, too, both of these sophisticates of amateur theater, were mouths agape in admiration, for here was a stage presence that could overcome not only amateurism but the common cold. Owen had overcome error and bad acting and deviation from the script. Then I came to the faces in the congregation that Owen must have seen about the same time I saw them. They bore the most rapt expressions of all. They were Mr. and Mrs. Meany's faces. Mr. Meany's granitic countenance was destroyed by fear, but his attention was riveted. And Mrs. Meany's lunatic gawking was characterized by a naked incomprehension. She had her hands clenched together in violent prayer, and her husband held her around her shaking shoulders because she was racked by sobs as disturbing as the animal unhappiness of a retarded child. Owen sat up so suddenly in the mountain of hay that several front pew members of the congregation were startled into gasps and cries of alarm. He bent stiffly at the waist, like a tightly wound spring, and he pointed with ferocity at his mother and father. To many members of the congregation, he could have been pointing to anyone or to them all.
"What do you think you're doing here?"
the angry Lord Jesus screamed. Many members of the congregation thought he meant them. I could tell what a shock the question was for Mr. Fish, but I knew whom Owen was speaking to. I saw Mr. and Mrs. Meany cringe. They slipped off the pew to the kneeling pad, and Mrs. Meany covered her face with both hands.
"You shouldn't be here!"
Owen shouted at them. But Mr. Fish, and surely half the congregation, felt that they stood accused. I saw the faces of the Reverend Lewis Merrill and his California wife. It was apparent that they also thought Owen meant them.
"It is a sacrilege for you to be here,"
Owen hollered. At least a dozen members of the congregation guiltily got up from the pews at the rear of the church to leave. Mr. Meany helped his dizzy wife to her feet. She was crossing herself repeatedly, a helpless, unthinking Catholic gesture. It must have infuriated Owen. The Meanys conducted an awkward departure. They were big, broad people, and their exit out of the crowded pew, their entrance into the aisle, where they stood out so alone, their every movement was neither easy nor graceful. "We only wanted to see you," Owen's father told him apologetically. But Owen Meany pointed to the door at the end of the nave, where several of the faithful had already departed. Owen's parents, like that other couple who were banished from the garden, left Christ Church as they were told.
Not even the gusto with which the choir, following frantic signals from the rector, sang Hark the Herald Angels Sing, could spare the congregation the indelible image of how the meanies had obeyed their only son. Rector Wigan, wringing the Bible in both hands, was trying to catch the eye of his wife, but Barb Wigan was struck as immovable as stone. What the rector wanted was for his wife to darken the pillar of light, which continued to shine on the wrathful Lord Jesus.
"Get me out of here!"
the Prince of Peace said to Joseph. And what is Joseph, if not a man who does what he's told? I lifted him. Mary Beth Baird wanted to hold a part of him, too. Whether his goosing her had deepened her infatuation or had put her in her place without trampling an iota of her ardor is uncertain. Regardless, she was his slave, at his command. And so, together, we raised him out of the hay. He was so stiffly wrapped it was like carrying an unmanageable icon. He simply wouldn't bend, no matter how we held him. Where to go with him was not instantly clear. The back way, behind the altar area, the unobserved route we'd all taken to the manger, was blocked by Barb Wigan. As in other moments of indecision, the Christ child directed us. He pointed down the center aisle, in the direction his parents had taken. I doubt that anyone directed the cows and donkeys to follow us. They just needed the air. Our procession gathered the force and numbers of a marching band. The third verse of what was supposed to be the Reverend Mr. Wigan's recessional carol heralded our exit. Mild he lays his glory by, born that man no more may die, born to raise the sons of earth, born to give them second birth. All the way down the center aisle, Barb Wigan kept the pillar of light on us. What possible force could have compelled her to do that? There was nowhere to go but out, into the snow and cold. The cows and the donkeys tore off their heads so that they could get a better look at him. For the most part, these were the younger children. Some of them, a very few of them, were actually smaller than Owen. They stared at him, in awe. The wind whipped through his swaddling clothes and his bare arms grew rosy. He hugged them to his bird-like chest. The meanies, sitting scared in the cab of the granite truck, were waiting for him. The Virgin Mother and I hoisted him into the cab. Because of how he was swaddled, he had to be extended full length across the seat. His legs lay in his father's lap, not quite interfering with Mr. Meany's control of the steering wheel, and his head and upper body rested upon his mother, who had reverted to her custom of looking not quite out the window and not quite at anything at all.
"My clothes,"
the Lord Jesus told me.
"You get them and keep them for me."
"Of course," I said.
"It's a good thing I wore my lucky scarf,"
he told me.
"Take me home,"
he ordered his parents, and Mr. Meany lurched the truck into gear. A snowplow was turning off Front Street onto Elliott. It was customary in Gravesend to make way for snowplows, but even the snowplow made way for Owen. Toronto, February 4, 1987. There was almost no one at the Wednesday morning communion service. Holy Eucharist is better when you don't have to shuffle up the aisle in a herd and stand in line at the communion railing like an animal awaiting space at the feeding trough, just like another consumer at a fast food service. I don't like to take communion with a mob. I prefer the way the Reverend Mr. Foster serves the bread to the mischievous style of Canon Mackey. The canon delights in giving me the tiniest wafer he has in his hand, a veritable crumb, or else he gives me an inedible hunk of bread almost too big to fit in my mouth and impossible to swallow without prolonged chewing. The canon likes to tease me. He says,
"Well, I figure that you take communion so often, it's probably bad for your diet. Someone's got to look after your diet, John."
And he chuckles about that. Or else he says,
"Well, I figure that you take communion so often, you must be starving. Someone's got to give you a decent meal."
And he chuckles some more.
The Reverend Mr. Foster, our priest associate, at least dispenses the bread with a uniform sense of sacredness. That's all I ask. I have no quarrel with the wine. It is ably served by our honorary assistants, the Reverend Mr. Larkin and the Reverend Mrs. Keeling, Mrs. Catherine Keeling. She's the headmistress at the Bishop Strawn School, and my only qualm with her is when she's pregnant. The Reverend Catherine Keeling is often pregnant, and I don't think she should serve the wine when she's so pregnant that bending forward to put the cup to our lips is a strain. That makes me nervous. Also, when she's very pregnant and you're kneeling at the railing waiting for the wine, it's distracting to see her belly approach you at eye level. Then there's the Reverend Mr. Larkin. He sometimes pulls the cup back before the wine has touched your lips. You have to be quick with him. And he's a little careless how he wipes the rim of the cup each time. Of them all, the Reverend Mrs. Keeling is the best to talk to, now that Canon Campbell is gone. I truly like and admire Catherine Keeling. I regretted I couldn't talk to her today, when I really needed to talk to someone. But Mrs. Keeling is on temporary leave. She's off, having another baby. The Reverend Mr. Larkin is as quick to be gone from a conversation as he is quick with a communion cup, and our priest associate, the Reverend Mr. Foster, although he burns with missionary zeal, is impatient with the fretting of a middle-aged man like myself, who lives in such comfort in the Forest Hill part of town. The Reverend Mr. Foster is all for opening a mission on Jarvis Street, and counseling hookers on the subject of sexually transmitted diseases, and he's up to his neck in volunteer projects for the West Indians on Bathurst Street, the very same people so verbally abused by Deputy Warden Holt. But the Reverend Mr. Foster offers scant sympathy for my worries, which, he says, are only in my mind. I love that. Only. And that left Canon Mackey to talk to today. Canon Mackey presents a familiar problem. I said, "Did you read the paper? Today's paper, the Globe and Mail? It was on the front page." "No, I've not had time to read the paper this morning," Canon Mackey said. "But let me guess. Was it something about the United States? Something President Reagan said?" He is not exactly condescending, Canon Mackey. He is inexactly condescending. "There was a nuclear test yesterday, the first U.S. explosion of 87, I said. "It was scheduled for tomorrow, but they moved it up. It was a way to fool the protesters. Naturally, there were planned protests for tomorrow." "Naturally," said Canon Mackey. "And the Democrats had scheduled a vote for today on a resolution to persuade Reagan to cancel the test," I told the canon. "The government even lied about the day the test was going to be. A fine use of the taxpayers' money, eh?" "You're not a taxpayer in the United States. Not anymore," the canon said. "The Soviets said they wouldn't test any weapons until the U.S. tested first," I told the canon. "Don't you see how deliberately provocative this is? How arrogant? How unconcerned with any arms agreement of any kind. Every American should be forced to live outside the United States for a year or two. Americans should be forced to see how ridiculous they appear to the rest of the world. They should listen to someone else's version of themselves, to anyone else's version. Every country knows more about America than Americans know about themselves. And Americans know absolutely nothing about any other country." Canon Mackey observed me mildly. I could see it coming. I talk about one thing, and he bends the subject of our conversation back to me. "I know you were upset about the vestry elections, John," he told me. "No one doubts your devotion to the church, you know." Here I am, talking about nuclear war and the usual self-righteous American arrogance, and Canon Mackey wants to talk about me. "Surely you know how much this community respects you, John," the canon told me. "But don't you see how your opinions can be disturbing? It's very American to have opinions as strong as your opinions. It's very Canadian to distrust strong opinions." "I'm a Canadian," I said,
I've been a Canadian for 20 years.
Canon Mackey is a tall, stooped, bland-faced man, so plainly ugly that his ungainly size is unthreatening, and so plainly decent that even his stubbornness of mind is not generally offensive.
"John, John," he said to me, "you're a Canadian citizen, but what are you always talking about? You talk about America more than any American I know."
"And you're more anti-American than any Canadian I know," the canon said. "You're a little, well, one note on the subject, wouldn't you say?"
"No, I wouldn't," I said.
"John, John," Canon Mackey said, "your anger, that's not very Canadian either." The canon knows how to get to me, through my anger.
"No, and it's not very Christian either," I admitted.
"I'm sorry."
"Don't be sorry," the canon said cheerfully. "Try to be a little different."
The man's pauses are almost as irritating as his advice.
"It's the damn Star Wars thing that gets to me," I tried to tell him. "The only constraint on the arms race that remains is the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty between the United States and the Soviet Union. Now Reagan has given the Soviets an open invitation to test nuclear weapons of their own, and if he proceeds with his missiles in space plans, he'll give the Soviets an open invitation to junk the treaty of 1972 as well."
"You have such a head for history," the canon said. "How can you remember the dates?"
"Canon Mackey," I said.
"John, John," the canon said. "I know you're upset. I'm not mocking you. I'm just trying to help you understand about the vestry elections."
"I don't care about the vestry elections," I said angrily, indicating, of course, how much I cared.
"I'm sorry," I said.
The canon put his warm, moist hand on my arm.
"To our younger parish officers," he said, "you're something of an eccentric. They don't understand those years that brought you here. They wonder why, especially when you defame the United States as vociferously as you do, why you aren't more Canadian than you are. Because you're not really a Canadian, you know, and that troubles some of the older members of this parish, too. That troubles even those of us who do remember the circumstances that brought you here. If you made the choice to stay in Canada, why do you have so little to do with Canada? Why have you learned so little about us?
John, it's something of a joke, you know, how you don't even know your way around Toronto."
That is Canon Mackey in a nutshell. I worry about a war, and the canon agonizes about how I get lost the second I step out of Forest Hill. I talk about the loss of the most substantive treaty that exists between the Soviet Union and the United States, and the canon teases me about my memory for dates. Yes, I have a good head for dates. How about August 9, 1974? Richard Nixon was finished. How about September 8, 1974? Richard Nixon was pardoned. And then there was April 30, 1975. The U.S. Navy evacuated all remaining personnel from Vietnam. They called this Operation Frequent Wind. Canon Mackey is skillful with me, I have to admit. He mentions dates